to this week's episode of GovX Data Points, where we talk all things government and data. I'm your co-host, Eric Reese, as always, along with co-host Sharon Paley.
We're really excited to bring you this week's podcast. It's just about Thanksgiving time here in the U.S., and so that's a time where ideally we gather around a table together and share a good meal and have brilliant conversation with our friends and families. And so that's the idea for this week's podcast, to bring you into the GovX family, introduce you to some of the great people that Eric and I get to work with every day, and talk to them about what they're doing with data and government and where they look for great information.
To do that this week, we're going to figuratively bring you into the family and literally inside the trailer that we all work in together. And so I want to introduce first the three folks that are going to be participating in the conversation today. So first we have Sheila Dugan, one of our senior advisors on the team. We also have Matt Pozzolis, another senior advisor working with cities across the country. And we have Sophia Dengo, who is an analyst on our team. And each of them has a really unique perspective in terms of the work that they do and they're interested in, but also the resources that they use and look for as they, you know, do our work with cities across the country and around the world. No more introductions, we're just gonna dive right in. And the first question that I wanna pose to the group is, first, just as you're doing your work, generally, where do you go to find resources and where do you look for best practices across the country and across the world?
For me, I just start with the cities that I know are really trying to push the envelope and they're doing well in these particular areas, thinking about open data and performance analytics. So San Francisco, I like to keep my finger on their pulse and seeing what they're doing. Also, I think there are certain magazines like Governing that actually highlight some best practices across the country. I think one of the best parts about working as part of this What Works Cities initiative is the fact that we actually have connections to cities all across the country. So very often through someone, I can actually speak directly to the person who's doing the cool thing, and I don't have to go through a reporter or read a case study to figure out what's happening in a city. But I understand that's a privilege I have just because my job is so wonderful.
Obviously, annual reviews are coming up soon.
Yeah,
yeah, I go to the GovX website. That's a lot of great best practices really inform my practice. So a lot of really successful cities will want to share what they've been up to and how they've approached a lot of these problems. And so around the country at this time especially, there's a lot of conferences going on where people give presentations on this, and a lot of those are made publicly online. So one area is the University of Chicago's Data Science for Social Good conference that we attended earlier this year, and you should check out that podcast as well. But they went on and they published a description of all of the projects that they did, as well as some of the source code for how they did it on there. And so you can go and see presentations, you can go and see topics and get in touch with those folks that were giving those talks, because a lot of times they are really happy to share that information and talk about how it's been going since then and give you an update on all of that as well.
So I approach things a little bit differently because my job is a little bit different. I do some development for GovX, and my background is as a web developer, so I'm looking less for best practices in terms of city work specifically and more for best practices and resources around how to implement different technology tools for the work that we do. I, like Sheila, have a pretty robust network through both GovX and then also Code for America, so I tend to look to them first because they've got it kind of on lock in terms of how to provide tech services. Outside of that, when I get really lost, I go to Stack Overflow. Stack Overflow for Python, Stack Overflow for GitHub, Stack Overflow for all the things that have to do with code.
So I think that the question that, in a way, almost goes before the question we just asked you is, how do you identify a best practice? How do you know a best practice when you see it versus just something that someone is doing?
For me, it's looking at the actual outcomes. I think, unfortunately, I don't even think it's just a government problem. People have this habit of writing like really nice reports and putting out very pretty visualizations, and it looks like you're accomplishing a lot. But this is why I like to talk to people, because you can understand what the actual impact is. So you've developed a cool way to do your data inventory. Did you actually get a quality data inventory out of it? You developed a way to prioritize prioritize the release of data? Are you actually releasing data according to the schedule that you put out for yourself? So for me, it's like waiting, especially looking at practices that have matured a while, that have happened a while ago, and actually seeing whether it's had some impact at all on the city or municipality.
Yeah, a lot of times, you know, cities will be facing the same issues and the same struggles about how to operationalize their data as well. And so looking to other cities that have had established programs and how that has played out there and what they've been able to accomplish has been very helpful. Especially around, you know, performance stat type meetings and, you know, what is the best practice around follow-ups, or how do you encourage accountability or collaboration along those lines. And so many different cities have been experimenting with different tactics and trying to see, you know, which ones have had more success than others, and where might there be some data fatigue setting in, and some things that you might want to avoid as well. You know, that kind of the flip side of that coin is also very helpful to know what didn't work in other cities. But, you know, trying to see what the actual outcome, like Sheila was saying, how has that played out within the community?
So I look for things that are established in the academic community and in the community of practice. So going just tech-based again, right, like there's really established academic research around user experience, and there's established academic research around best practices in code. And then there is also the outcome, like, okay, I did it this way, did it work? But I do tend to kind of go back to the establishment. And I rely a lot on people whose code I know is solid. And when I say solid, I don't necessarily mean the most beautiful bug-free code in existence. I mean, they made a product that's stable and is doing its job. So there is kind of an outcome from there as well.
Back to Matt.
Yeah, and I would also say, especially in the programming and coding community, you know, there are a lot of best practices that are established. You know, there's a term in Python called, you know, Pythonic code. And so there's many different ways that you might be able to accomplish a task, to solve a problem, but there's also, you know, better ways of doing it than others, and ways that, you know, are more efficient, ways that can get things done faster, ways that are less error prone, and things like that. That, you know, looking up how do you what is the appropriate way of going about doing this, or the Pythonic way if you're coding in Python, can be very helpful as well.
There's also the element of security lately. The cyber has become a thing. Sorry, I couldn't resist. you know, cybersecurity is important, right? Like making sure that everybody's using HTTPS everywhere if they can. So I also look for solutions and approaches to problems that are secure, because there are ways that you can build things that are horribly insecure and are going to open you up to a bunch of different problems. And then there are ways to build things that are more closed and not as prone to getting hacked.
So I'm curious to get your thoughts, all three of you, on what do you do next? How do you take those best practices and actually operationalize them in your work? How do you recommend cities start doing that? I see that the folks in Seattle are doing something really cool, and I want to do something similar. What do you recommend as the next steps that someone in that situation would take?
Generally speaking, I think when you see a city or an individual or an organization doing something cool, and you want to try and emulate that as much as possible, the first thing you want to know is, how did you do that cool thing? Right? Because what you're seeing, presumably, is the result. You don't necessarily know what the process was to get there. And I think something that might often surprise people is that it looks really great and perfect at the end, but the process to get there was probably not a straight, you know, ascending line. It was probably a crazy, loopy, tangled thing. And so, you know, Sheila mentioned earlier being able to reach out and have conversations with people. I think that's true across the board, whether it's city work or tech work or some amalgamation of the two. If you can go and talk to the creators and figure out where they had problems, where they have suggestions to help you out, what resources they can give you, you can start there and then build on your own.
I think that's a really great point, because a lot of places, you know, I think it's the Instagram effect, where people will present a curated view of how things turned out that gives it in the best possible light, because everybody wants to think that, you know, everybody, you know, governments want to present this, you know, polished image of them as efficient and effective and competent and knowing what they're doing. But, you know, like we were saying, it's not often a very straight path, and there are hurdles and challenges and roadblocks to overcome. And in hindsight, I think that sometimes when people especially are pioneering a new process, they might want to try to do things differently the next time around, or if they were doing it over. And so being able to glean those insights from people who have already been through it can give you a big leg up when you're trying to implement that in your own city.
I think there's also something to be said for both when you are asked for help and when you are asking for help to ask literally for the thing that went wrong. There's a thing among pilots when they screw up, especially if it's like a group of pilots or a group of astronauts, when they screw something up, they get into a meeting and they talk about how badly they screwed up and why they screwed up and how they could possibly fix it. The idea being not to stand up and go mea culpa, but mostly to stand up and be like, you don't do this. You know, don't go sliding off the end of the runway. I'm telling you this so that you don't make the same mistake that I made, because I looked like an incompetent person or somebody who was screwing things up. And now you don't have to. You get to save face on my mistake. And I think it's a really difficult thing to do, to stand up and say, look, I really, really messed this up and this is why. But if you can do that, then you establish a best practice for fixing mistakes or repairing errors.
I would just like to reiterate the points that you guys made earlier around making sure that you're connecting the two parties. So I like for the cities to talk to each other, especially if they're about to run a process that happened in another city, to see how it actually happened and what implementation was really like on the ground. Review any documentation that the city has available and start to think about the differences and the similarities between the two cities to figure out what's possible and what they could scale back on.
So this is kind of a follow-up question to this based on a little bit of what I heard you all say. And some of this is about creating safe spaces to talk about things that have failed. Most of the time, government officials don't feel comfortable doing that. And so part one of the follow-up question is, how do we create spaces where that is okay? And part two is also related in some ways that people know that everything's not perfect in government. How do we start to talk about that in a way that makes sense for the average person, that acknowledges that not everything's perfect, but also that we're working to make things better, and here's XYZ things that we're doing to improve. So I hear a lot of that from folks that I work with, and I heard a little bit of that in some of the things that you all just said, but I want to bring that out a little bit more, hear about your thoughts on those questions.
So I think you started to answer your own question when you were saying, talking about exposing to people, saying publicly, look, we know everything's not perfect, but we're working to do it better, and this is how we're working. I think if you can show the effort that you're making, that can sort of mitigate that feeling that this is not perfect and government is not perfect. And I have something super specific for creating a safe space. It's something I've done a couple times, and it tends to be pretty effective. You do a fail con. You pull a bunch of people together and you go, we're not going to talk about anything other than how we failed. And we're gonna do it maybe with some coffee or some beer or some donuts or whatever, but this is not a place where you're going to be reprimanded or censured. This is a place where you're going to sit and talk about your failure so we can figure out how to avoid it later.
A lot of this also has to do with the concepts of transparency and collaboration and trying to create this as a learning environment that's open and part of the community and not seen as something that stands apart from the community, that government is, you know, of the people, and it is staffed by residents, you know, it's a collaborative effort to try to improve everybody's life. It's not a separate organization that is closed, that is secretive, that is trying to do its own agenda, and people have to kind of watch it or try to see, like, you know, create this atmosphere of accountability. And trying to push this in a more innovative direction where people can focus on the learning aspects of this. And a big part of that, like Sophia is saying, is that sort of that fail. And so I've seen some examples of this where in police departments, for instance, they will take all of the disciplinary actions that have been taken. They'll make that, you know, internally available so that it's not as part of a shaming exercise, but it's so that people can learn from other people's mistakes. They can, you know, learn and improve and see that, you know, this is not about trying to pile on to an individual or something like this. But if we don't know what's going wrong, it's going to be a lot harder for everybody to pick up on that.
I'm going to answer the first question that you asked first. How do you create safe spaces? And I think especially through the What Works Cities network, I've learned that it's really important to create like more curated experiences for cities. So instead of having general conversations about housing, thinking about the specific challenges that the cities have, like whether it's blight or affordable housing, and connecting those particular cities. And I think when you begin to be a little bit more specific about those challenges, I think cities begin to open up with each other, especially if they're in a forum where they're just talking with their colleagues from other states and cities. So I think that's really important. In terms of making sure that governments are comfortable and residents are open to experimentation, I think it's important to change your language around what you're doing. I think in the past, governments would have this ribbon cutting ceremony moment where you're launching a new program or you're starting a new initiative, and that signals to the public, hey, this is new, it started, it's complete, and so you should expect everything to go well. But if you change your language about the way you're launching a program and you acknowledge that it's iterative, that you're going to probably make mistakes, that this program's evolving, I think people's expectations shift a little bit. And I think when you residents start to see their feedback reflected in the changes in the programs that you're making, I think that has people begin to appreciate you a little bit more. Like Sophia, I was a Code for America fellow, and the project we launched, we actually launched our MVP and we made it public facing a little sooner than some of the other groups. And we told the city employees that, hey, this isn't done yet. You're helping us test it. We're going to make this better. We told the public that, and they were quite comfortable with it. And we didn't get a lot of flack from the public when things didn't work perfectly because they understood what we were trying to do.
This is great because it's all so on Thanksgiving theme of like sharing, understanding, and open dialogue, and it's enough to make me weep. So, but not really. Everyone here knows I have no emotions. So we're looking, you know, down the barrel of Thanksgiving, and everyone's gonna get a lovely break from GovX.
Of Thanksgiving. I've never viewed Thanksgiving as a gun before.
But it's just an expression.
The cornucopia of Thanksgiving.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't
the musket of Thanksgiving.
There you go. And then we're all gonna get some time off from GovX, which is also, that's bittersweet, right? We're hiring, by the way. What are you planning to do? Are you planning to do anything like work-related? Are you planning to read anything work-related, or do, you know, employer development skills in some way that our audience would find interesting over the break?
I got an email randomly a few weeks ago from some ebook company that I'm forgetting the name of, going, hey, you know, there's this great new Python book out, and it was in e-format and it was free. I have two thoughts on software development books. One, they cost a fortune, and two, they're usually out of date as soon as they hit the print. So a free ebook version sounded great to me. I've already gotten an updated version, so I might be spending some time with that.
Got a lot of projects to do.
You just bought a house. Yeah, you do.
I feel like there's always a backlog of articles that I need to read because everyone's always like sending, like, look at this cool thing happening in Seattle, or look at what's happening in Chattanooga, and I do not read those articles because I'm working, and I do not read them on weekends because
you're weekending.
Yeah, yeah.
You're recharging so that you can come back to work on Monday.
Something like that. So, probably reading the backlog of those articles and then like reading obsessively every article about the election and polling that I can get my hands
on. Don't do that to yourself.
So, last question: is there anything if you're a listener to this podcast and you have a couple days for Thanksgiving, what is one thing? Choose one. Can be work related, can not be work related, doesn't matter to me. What's one thing that you should do over the Thanksgiving break that you are going to do as well?
If you are like us, we have a lot of passion about our work and we want to spend a lot of time thinking about how we can essentially make our communities better. Take some time to actually do something non-work related, read a poem, watch a stupid television show, talk to a family member, hopefully one that you like, and just relax for a bit.
I'm going to be that guy that gives a schlocky answer here, but I think that especially in the wake of the election that many people found very stressful and went on for far too long and is now proving to be even more divisive as ever, and will lead to a lot of really interesting conversations around the dinner table. But just spend time with people that you love, and if you can get out to your community and reconnect with people around you, do some service work, just be around people that you love to recharge and go into the new year with a positive attitude.
Man, you're already at the new year.
Yeah, you got a whole month left.
He's October flew by, November's halfway over. He's We're going to be in retirement soon.
So I will echo what Sheila and Matt have said, and I will add something because I look around my office and I look around at all my people, and I think we're all chronically sleep deprived. So sleep. Get a full 8 hours at least one night. I swear. Like everybody I've spoken to in the last week has been like, man, I haven't been sleeping, or I've been changing time zones, or I've been on too many airplanes, whatever. Sleep.
I believe that Thanksgiving is a time for eating pie and watching football and a parade full of balloons if you can get in your full night's sleep early enough to be up at 9 a.m. on Thursday.
That sounds good. So I will not be watching football as the Bears are pretty much the worst team then, besides the Browns.
No, the Browns.
Besides the Browns. They're like
our
the
apologies to Cleveland. They have a great NBA team. Sorry. They have a great baseball team. Yeah.
They're really proud of both of them right now. I just came back from Cleveland.
As well they should be. Browns, not so much. But otherwise, thank you all for joining us today. We appreciate the perspectives of everyone on our team. We hope to do stuff like this more often to get our listeners more exposed to all the great folks that are working on the GovX team and working with us across the country. So thanks again, have a good Thanksgiving, and join us again soon to find out where the data points.